Many years ago in Bombay, India, this European gentleman, John Klein, was walking without intention, free from all thoughts. A flock of birds flying in the sky appeared in his unclouded vision, and suddenly he realized that consciousness is, and that there is only consciousness. This simple but momentous realization was not an accident. It was the culmination of a voyage. For the past 30 years, Jean has been offering the joy of real living to all who are interested. Musicologist, medical doctor, he is one who has realized the freedom that lies at the heart of life. Hello, I'm Lilias Folan, and we've come to explore the teachings of Jean Klein, and we invite you to join us. Jean, hello. Welcome. I'm so glad that you're here and glad that you can be with us. I'm very interested in starting out with my first question is, how did these teachings come to you? What was the beginning?
The teaching came to me. You know, when you are brought up in an earnest way, there are moments in life that you ask, what is life? What is the source of life? Who am I? And this question, who am I, I would say, in this moment, the teaching comes to you.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything special when you were a young boy that happened to you as a young boy that encouraged you on the spiritual path?
My mother said that very often between two games that I was sitting in a very curious way, silent. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, it was not daydreaming.
Really? Really? And then, so as a young man, you didn't have any formal training. You had your childhood and went on into, mm-hmm. perhaps as a young man, were there any turning points?
Yes. When you constantly be in appropriation of knowledge, studying, at a certain age, around 15, 16, you said to you, what about it? Mm-hmm. Accumulation of knowledge. What brings it to you? Then you begin to read Tolstoy, Dostoevsky. You become an anarchist, revolutionaire.
Did you start the violin at that time?
Earlier.
Earlier?
I started the violin when I was 6 and a half.
Did you?
Yes.
But then from the Tolstoy and the reading, and then there was a big jump. Probably the Second World War was there, that was terrific part of your life. And then you got to India. What called you to India?
In any case, not the research for a guru. I went to India to explore a society which still lives in a traditional way. And of course, when you are young, you dream of Maharajas and white elephants. So I thought then they are the right elements, elephants which brought me to India.
What year was that? 1950?
That was 1951.
Well, India must have been just a very exciting place. I mean, it's an exciting place now. But it must have been a very exciting place. And but you didn't go with the idea of finding a teacher.
Without any purpose.
No purpose at all.
No.
Then, but you did meet a teacher in India.
Yes.
Could you just tell us a little bit how you met him and who he was?
I had some friends who invited me very often at home and spoke me that they have a teacher. And so one day I met the teacher, asked him many questions. And this man has been later become my teacher. And one day I went to its home. Its home was a little room in the Sanskrit college. He was a teacher of Sanskrit in the university in Bangalore. And after reading certain Upanishads, and they asked him a certain number of questions, he said to me, "Do you know yourself?" And I said, to a certain extent, yes. For me, knowing myself was body, senses, and mind. Mm-hmm. And then I said, to a certain extent, yes. He said, "Do you know the knower of it?" It's what's very striking to me, that I am a knower of what so-called I am, body, senses, and mind. So as I have no reference to the knower, for a long time I have been in this state of not knowing the knower.
Yes.
And after, he has been become my teacher.
In this day and age, I have found it a question that I have. Does one need a teacher for this spiritual path?
Strictly speaking, there's nothing to teach. You need a teacher for science, for singing, for learning a language. But to teach you what you are fundamentally, I think the word teaching is not appropriate.
What is then appropriate?
Appropriate would be to tell you what you are not. Because what you are, you can never know it. Because it is the knowing. Because there's no knower to know it. It is its own knowing.
Well, I know this intellectually, but I don't know it. And certainly it's my quest. And when I say my quest, John, I feel like I'm speaking for many people, you know, that are at this place, that have an inkling, they see, and they truly thirst for more. And but are there teachers, I hate to use the word available, but are there teachers on this planet that can help, you know, smooth the way and move things along a little bit quicker for people?
Yes, there are people who can stimulate you for the inquiring what you are. That is true. That is true. So kind of what we call upagurus,
What does one do, though, that can't travel or, you know, there you are, you're in wherever you live, and you can't travel, and the teacher is perhaps in another city or in another area of the world. How would we begin to this self-inquiry if you were on your own?
It is true, but I tell you, for example, Atmananda, Krishna Manan, met once enlightened man. And that's all, only once. It seems, one said, he disappeared to Calcutta. He haven't seen anyone anymore. So it's not the problem of duration, of how often. One meeting can be something, a revolution in you.
Can one have many spiritual teachers in their life? And is there a difference between a spiritual teacher and a guru? Mm.
You can have a certain number of advisors, but you can have only one teacher. The teaching, if you still keep the word teaching, is to show you in absolutely deep way that you are not body, senses, and mind, that you are the self. And in this moment, you may say, this is my teacher. But if you explore your own word, teacher, you will see you cannot find him as a person. And the teacher, he presents never himself as a teacher, because he's love, he's consciousness. So he will never take you as an ignorant, as a student. So there's a moment that you will not find stimulation in you to be an ignorant, a student. And he has not the pretension to be a guru, a teacher. So what happens when two, which are not two, comes together? Two in stillness, two free from all representation to be something, this or that. That is a kind of flame. You feel it, as I said to you yesterday or yesterday before, you feel it without feeling it.
My question was going to be, the next question was going to be, do you outgrow it, teachers? And I think you've answered that. It sounds like you don't, perhaps, yes, you do outgrow teachers.
I think you can consider it your teacher for your teacher when he takes you free from yourself, free what you are not. Then you find a kind of autonomy. That is important. When the teacher touches you to him, then be careful. He makes you free from yourself and free from himself. And when both are free, there is love. There's a current of love. There is friendship. So you see, that's a kind, very delicate situation. It asks for a very deep intimacy.
Yes. I know we talk a lot about an inner teacher, the teacher within, and especially now what we all call the New Age. And, what do you think about the word New Age?
We can really say there are not at least one century where there are not two wars and many things. So the new age is, of course, to refer ourselves to a new way of thinking, feeling, and acting. And this way, I think, it's a new age.
Yes. And it's a good thing.
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
Wonderful.
Absolutely. Really.
Gets people thinking, yes. And it's exciting and yes. For them and gets them alive.
Yes.
But is there such a tangible thing as an inner teacher, inner guidance? Is that an inner teacher?
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you can tell him, teacher. It is life. Life is a teacher.
Yes. All of my time of my questing and voyaging on this spiritual voyage, I've heard the word enlightenment, and I've heard it many times, but I still don't know what it means. I know what it means on a piece of paper, but what is enlightenment? It seems to be something I'm going towards. It's even something, you know, it's my end result of something. And just what is it?
When you see in one moment that you are not body, senses, mind. That means body, senses, mind have no reality in itself. Depends on consciousness. Depends on your presence. Then there is a natural giving up what you are not. And this giving up, you don't give up anything, but your understanding brings to the giving up. You will find yourself suddenly in a completely new dimension. A dimension which don't emphasize the object, body, senses, mind, but which emphasize the light. That is enlightenment. In other words, more simply, in the moment that you understand there's nobody. You may occasionally be a woman, occasionally be this or that personality from this or this country. But it appears occasionally. But what you are in your totality, in your fullness, in your completeness, you are the self. You are the I am. That, see that you are not the person, that you are the I am, is a kind of form of enlightenment. Mm. It is very difficult to give, with our language, with our representation, the quality, if we can speak of the quality, what we call to come in this completely new dimension.
Is it a gradual thing? Is it a gradual thing for some and sort of a hit over the head for others? Does it keep growing?
Your question is right. The understanding that you are the ultimate observer, the ultimate subject, the ultimate knower of all objects, that is progressively a progression in seeing things clear. But the I am is suddenly instantaneous, because it doesn't go through the mind. Because what you are fundamentally is beyond the mind. So the deal with the mind, it is a waste of, I would say, of energy. That's why there's a direct way, point directed to the I am. Of course, a purified body, relaxed body, is also a relaxed mind, a purified mind. And as the mind of the body belongs to your completeness, your totality, there's a kind of echo, a kind of taste, kind of perfume, but it's beyond the mind, but it's only a perfume.
It's really interesting to hear you talk about going behind the mind, and you don't have to go through it, you know, to...
No.
But how do you do that? Is that something spontaneous, or is that developed slowly, happens quickly?
You lost the key of your flat. And you cannot go in your flat. What happens in this moment? Your mind is completely furnished with all kind of places where you could put the key. Many, many places immediately, simultaneously suggest you there could be the key. You moved everywhere. You are completely agitated. And suddenly you find the key in a completely unexpected place. Mm-hmm. What happens in the moment? All the imagination, representation goes away. You will find yourself in a completely open state.
That is something that we all have experienced too,
yes.
those times.
In astonishment. Mm. And you are astonished.
Really?
Yes. When you are completely astonished, the object which brought you to be astonished is not present. You are...
Yes. Oh, that's a wonderful thought.
Yes. Or an admiring. An admiring, there's not an admirer and somebody admired. It is admiring. You're full. You live here in your fullness, your completeness.
Jean, some teachers do the body work without the self-inquiry. And some teachers do a lot of self-inquiry without body work. But uniquely, you do both, and I've experienced just a little bit of the body work. But would you just explain a little bit how it came to being and perhaps some of its importance?
Body work without inquiring, self-inquiring, is very fractional. It's only a fractional value. I think inquiring and also body awareness should be together. Mm-hmm. Mm. Because when you say, I am not body, senses, and mind, it is not only a concept and idea to say, I am not this and that. You must know exactly what is the nature of what you are not. So the inquiring, the exploring the body is important in a certain way. Or the contraction, or the fear, or the anxiety, or the reactions, the resistance. You should take note of it. Note of it, I mean, not to be an accomplice with it. The moment you listen to it, you listen to it, yes. And you become aware of it, in your awareness, there's not an I, a me, who could feed it. So.
Did you say feel it or feed it?
Feed it.
Feed it.
Yes. So the moment you don't feed it, it goes away. So it is very important in a certain way, the body approach. And concerning the pranayama, it has for certain a kind of significance for vitality, for making stronger and so on. I understood it in this way, but it's not my teaching.
Yes.
I see it more or less from the spiritual point of view. And in this breathing of in and out, find the moments where there is a non-activity and be completely attuned to this non-activity. That means after exhalation, after inhalation. And there's a moment that you combine the two points of cessation of the activity. Then you live completely in stillness. Then the activity goes on, but you remain knowingly in the silence. So it is more the spiritual approach to pranayama. Of course, you must teach us, there are certain elements in it which belongs to the progressive way. But it is exactly when you tire, when you talk a child and say you must not do this one, or you must not do that one. It is in a certain way you give him a crutch not to do it. But you know you give it, you know personally in a few years he will know why not to do it. So it is here the same, exactly the same. It is more or less a help, but a very little help. So your question, I would say, the bodywork has a certain importance.
Yes, and a spiritual
yes.
importance to it too.
Yes.
It's so easy to go through life, let me just sort of say, it's so easy to hear, I am not this body yes. and I am not this mind. But gosh, when the body begins to hurt, yes. I really am this body. You know, you get pulled right into it immediately.
Yes, but in this moment, the body is an object of your observation. It's not you who suffers. The knower doesn't suffer. And very often suffering in the body is in non-acceptance. 50% of the pain is in non-acceptance of the body, of the pain. When the pain becomes really an object of your observation, free from the concept pain, because the concept pain is pain, is memory. So
it's painful.
Yes. So you must really face the actual state of pain. But you are not the pain. Pains point to the perceiver, but you are. It is the self which is the perceiver.
And I know we're just touching the mountaintops of this subject. I do know that. I'd like very much if you could share with us and perhaps demonstrate how you would teach the arm, just raising your arm perhaps, mm-hmm. and how the breath and the arm and your words, what would they be? It was fascinating to me the way you talked about sensation, the sensation mm-hmm. and moving the sensation of the arm
yes.
rather than the arm. But I'd like to have you just share your way, just for a few minutes, if you would.
Yes. When you give the order to your body or to your arm to behave in a certain way, there is the beginning of the behavior and then the end. That means at the end you have accomplished the posture. So what is important to go to the posture is to go not with the physical body, is a muscle construction, but with the energy body. The energy body, you feel it. It is in the beginning only the tactile sensation. That means the superficial sensation of your skin, but after it comes more deeper, a deeper level. And there you feel really a kind of dynamism. But you see very often when you go in the zoo and you see the wild animals, and even the cat, when you see the cat, how the cat walks, it walks through elasticity. It is not movement, it is springing elasticity. So when we move, from, there's no stopping. It is a continued line. And here is the same feeling, here is the same feeling, the same feeling, here, every time the same feeling. There's a kind of ghost which walks without any resistance, I would say.
And the breath?
And the breath, you go with it. In the beginning, you begin in certain movements with the inhalation or exhalation, or after exhalation or after inhalation. But when you become master of the energy, the inhalation and exhalation can be at any moment. And when you become aware of the posture, then you are constantly behind the posture. You are the light of the posture. The difference is when you are absorbed, identified with the posture, or when the posture is in your awareness, in your observation. It is very important that the body approaches in this way, that you are open listening, and that's a posture, open listening in timeless, in absence of time, in the timeless, that the posture is in your timeless attention, in your timeless welcoming.
Oh. You have said something that I find interesting, which is that the body, which is full of sensation, mm-hmm. is our nearest environment. And I'd like it if you could just talk a little bit more about the energy body, to just explain it just a little bit more to me. Perhaps not in just the postures, but in life. Or mm-hmm.
The energy body is, in a certain way, mainly by the people paralyzed. Because the reaction in our muscles and nerves are very strong, covered the energy body. So to come really to the energy body, we must proceed first with a very deep relaxation of muscles and nerves. Then the energy body comes to life. And then it is the energy body who takes the physical body in charge. And as you have some organic memory, even in every circumstances in life, you should have this energy body present.
And so therefore it can be developed and sensed through the practice.
Absolutely.
Practice. And it is different than Hatha Yoga, isn't it?
Completely different.
Could you just a little bit why it's different?
Because it is, in Hatha Yoga there is only mechanic movements. It is only the foot body which moves.
I see, yes. I'm very interested in listening also to your dialogues when I was with you for a weekend, and you use silence in such a wonderful way. You seem to be really using it. You're not afraid of silence. Most of us are really quite afraid of the silent moments. Would you speak about that?
Who is afraid? Who is afraid? Because in silence, there's a perfect, total disappearance of the ego, of the person, of the I. The I doesn't hold anymore, hold and ideas and beliefs.
Is that where the fear comes from?
Yes. It is a disappearance. The real birth is after the disappearance. The real birth is not the birth from your mother. The real birth is when there's a total giving up, that is the real birth. The birth in the total absence of yourself. There is the presence. There is the I am.
As an adult, why don't I know my true nature? Why don't I mean, I'm sitting here, but why aren't I conscious of the I am and my true nature?
It may be a very deep rooted reflex in you to take yourself for what you are not. Education, experience, habits, society has brought you what you are. That means I don't really feel myself, but one calls generally myself. In other words, you go away from it. You have suddenly moments of happiness. And these moments are not states. It's a non-state. In these moments you can't say I am happy in the course of my happiness. You see, you feel only happiness. Your whole total global being is in this happiness. The idea of somebody is not present at all. This moment you know them. But you come out that immediately the mind takes it for its own, or the ego takes it for its own. The cause of this happiness was this meeting, or this beautiful house, or this beautiful car, or a beautiful flower. But at the moment, it is completely causeless, happiness. So when you say, I am happy, it is a state. You are not happy. Happiness, you are totally happiness. That is love also.
Our children, do they come into this planet with that knowledge, with that, I don't mean knowledge up here, I mean, but just totally love, and do they come in this way, light?
Yes, yes.
We all did? We
all
did.
All. We are in the, in the womb of our mother. We try to appropriate us, to take food, or the emotion of the mother, or the food that the mother takes. And then the child appropriates itself once out of the womb of the mother. The kind of appropriation. And this co-appropriation, which belongs more or less mainly to biological survival, creates in a certain way a subtle me, a subtle I, for appropriating the world. But it is only a kind a useful tool. It is like our liver or our lungs. It is a tool, nothing else. You must, with one, you identify yourself, the child. But it is important to free oneself through this wrong identification. But the child, mainly, is a kind of, the word education is not wrong, is really wrong. I would say the child must be around beauty, not only beauty seeing, hearing, feeling, this is important. It is the beauty which builds this child, very important. And also in the education, so-called education, one must show the child how to look, not what to look. How to look, because in looking, you're free from memory. In looking, you are completely, you welcome the looked. And there's one day when you come to this kind of maturity, you will see the looker is what is looking for, what he is looking for.
How can we look as an adult at the world? Looking. Start that looking.
When there is only looking, without qualification, there is pure looking. There is not darkness. Try to look at an object and bring the looking back. There's nothing more to look, there's only looking.
Jean, I've heard you say that it takes a degree of maturity to come to what you call the direct way. And I and many others have been on a progressive way, is that what you called it?
Mm-hmm.
Progressive way, which I would think has many concepts and goal-oriented and many tendrils behind it. Is there a place for the progressive way along with the direct way? Perhaps you could explain it a little bit. Do they complement each other? Can one use the tools from this progressive way in that direct way of which you speak?
The progressive way, strictly speaking, cannot bring you to maturity. Maturity comes through inquiring. Inquiring, who am I? What is life? What I'm looking for, really. You know precisely your motive, and you have looked in many directions to find what you're looking for, peace, tranquility, happiness, full love, expression, and you haven't found it. then there's a moment that you ask the question. I have not found it nowhere. And then you come to this maturity of, I don't know. When you say, I don't know, your mind is completely unfurnished of something eventual to be known. You are completely empty. You are empty space. You are this vastness. You are the unfurnished void. And then you will find yourself in this dimension, in this objectless dimension, of this objectless beingness, awareness. So I don't say that certain tools which has been used in the progressive way cannot also sometimes used in the direct way, but the direct way points directly. It is why there are not several gurus, several teachers, there's only one teacher.
So the tool of meditation and prayer might be is very valuable. Is it an absolutely valuable tool, a must, something that really, if you're going to be on any of the paths, this you really we must learn this or do it?
Spontaneous thinking. Thinking which comes out of silence is praying. But praying for me is not asking.
Can you say a few more words about meditation?
The experience that you have in deep sleep is the source for the meditation. There would not be meditation without deep sleep. When you wake up in the morning, the body-mind, and you said, I slept well, it doesn't belong to the good feeling of the body-mind. It belongs to the experience in deep sleep of peace, absolute peace. This absolute peace, which still has reflected in the body-mind, gives you the push for meditation. So when you get up, when you give yourself to meditation, you will see in deep inquiring that there is not a meditator. Because the meditator is a mind projection. And there's nothing to meditate on because you can only meditate what you know already. So when you see it, there's a giving up. And there what remains is a current of love, of presence. Then meditation is from moment to moment, not only in the morning from 6 to 7,
Can you just a little bit more on that moment to moment, because all of us are work or we're with our children, or you know, it's hard to keep that perspective.
Yes, but when you are with your children, you don't take yourself as a mother or as a father or as an educate, somebody who educate. So when you have no representation of yourself, in the same moment you have not a representation of the child. What happens? There's a kind of coming together in love, in friendship. Otherwise, it is an object relationship, because the being a mother is an object, it's a concept. And the child is a concept too. So when the concept child and mother is eliminated, there's a coming together, there's love.
That's a lovely thought. Because I think this process of self-inquiry can get very intellectual at times, and it's fascinating. And where is the place of the heart in this pathway of self-inquiry?
The inquiring is looking deeper about facts. This, I would say, this kind of discrimination, discernment, evolves in your brain, in your head. There comes a moment that you say, I understood. But when you say, I understood that that an elephant is not a mice, that remains still this understanding in your head. But when you ask, who am I, which is not an object, which is not a concept, immediately this understanding becomes being understanding. And this being understanding immediately pulses in the heart. And then there is love. There's no more representation of any understanding. There's nothing to understand. All has been understood. That is love. So the heart is where the discrimination find its real dissolving. And as I say, that is the last door. The heart is the last door. The last and the last and the first door. You expand completely. Because love is expansion. As long as there's a construction, there's still the ego at home.
Can you open the heart with breathing? With thought?
No, you should never use thoughts for the heart. Thoughts is used for understanding. It must be clear. You must have the right perspective of things. You must see it very clearly. But this seeing clearly concerns us to the question, who am I? And we can never be an object of representation. But we are, can never be thought, can never be represented. So it is not an object of our understanding, as it is an understanding what we are fundamentally are, non-object, that brings us back to the heart.
And can the heart be open with breathing?
And this, I would say, right thinking is right breathing. When you think right, the breathing is different. When there's fear, the breath is agitated. When there's anxiety, when there's hate, the breath is agitated. When there's love, the breath is slowly, smoothly.
Jean, I've watched you close your classes and you place the palms of your hands together. And that is in namaste, is that correct?
Yes.
Tell me what namaste means.
Namaste means that my soul and your soul are one. That is to the neighbor, to all the people we know. That is for the guru.
The guru?
Yes. That is for the gods.
And that is for the gods?
Yes.
One more time. To all people?
Yes.
Yes.
For the guru.
To the guru. And
the
to the gods. Jean Klein, thank you. Thank you for being. God bless you.